Okay, I think we're finally there. Let's get started. Sorry about that. Just a little technological joke. Yeah. Well, let's pray and we'll get started technologically or otherwise. Lord, thank you for your faithfulness and mercy. Thank you that you are a God of great kindness and generosity, and that you stoop through your revelation to make yourself known to us and to love us and to find us, to draw us to yourself and to engage us, and then to send us into the world as people who are marked by your love. And we pray that tonight, as we think about some of the implications of that in relationship to work, that you will guide us and meet us, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. All this technology reminds me of a time not long ago when there was a meeting of the San Francisco Presbytery, and there's a movement that some of you will be very aware of and others may not be, that's called the emergent movement, the emergent church movement, or emerging church movement. Emergent is usually what it's called. And among other things, and there's lots of expressions of this, but in many cases what it involves is a serious use of certain kinds of technology in order to create certain sort of worship experiences which can be only made available through a heavy use of technology. So on this particular occasion, the presbytery was going to have its first kind of full-on exposure to emergent worship, which you can imagine the San Francisco Presbytery was already somewhat controversial. And anyway, it was hilarious and sad because, of course, it turned out to be one of those nights where there was no resolution to the technological glitch. And in fact, what was going to be an hour and a half worth of experience, all of which was going to be driven by technology, was completely shut down by a series of technological problems. And it was so amazing because what ended up happening was so wonderful, because the people who had planned it really had internalized everything they were planning to convey technologically. And as a consequence, they basically just were left having to orally present these stories, these images, this sense of community that was going to be created by this technological projection and then interacted with in various ways, had to end up being told in really kind of the most basic oral human tradition. And it was wonderful. It was a fabulous experience. And people, you know, cheered and said, let's have more emergent worship. It felt like it was emerging on many different levels. So in any case, so I'm glad it wasn't imperative tonight, but I'm glad that this worked. So what we're going to do is come to our theme of work in just a moment. But before we do that, I want us to step back just a little bit. Remember where we are, since it's been a few weeks since we've met in this format. You know that that the theme of this year is our life for God's world. And that so far what we've looked at is our kingdom calling. That was the first 4 weeks of our time together this fall. And then we are looking at the third of 4 weeks that we're spending together in this section, which is the section that I'm calling our public cross. The first week we thought about being citizens and residents of nations and what that means. Then we thought about global stewards. Then we took the two-week hiatus from this meeting format when we, on one night, had the opportunity to interact with what was going on with the HIV AIDS crisis and the discussions about that. And then we also had the opportunity to join in the Global Jesus and Evangelical Power Conference. And then last week, the chance to spend some time responding to that. And I found last Sunday evening and Sunday noon time, actually, as well, extremely encouraging and challenging as well. So there's lots more that we have yet to see unfold from the conference. But since the conference is so intrinsically tied into the themes of what we're doing in soul work this year, it seemed right that we should take the time to do that. So tonight we come to doing our work, which we're going to come to in a bit. But if we were to look back on the global stewards piece, last week I was going to say something more about this, but the conversation got too good with everyone else sharing their insights about the conference. So let me just summarize what I think the conference and that whole section was about, which is, in my mind, is sort of distilled into these three things. They're just three hooks, really. They're not meant as bumper stickers. They're meant just as a way of sort of remembering and holding on to certain things, which is what I'm calling believe cosmically, engage globally, and serve locally. By believe cosmically, what I am daring to affirm is what I think the Bible dares to affirm, which is that God's vision is a cosmic vision, and that God has been engaged in various kinds of revelation, all of which are meant to contribute in some way or another to our sense of comprehension and trust in that great cosmic picture. So you could look at Old Testament, New Testament alike. You could look at the Gospels. You could look at certain of Paul's letters. You could pick out, let's say, the introduction to Ephesians or the start of Colossians or other things where Paul's using this huge broad brush to try to portray what it is that God is about in the whole universe. And in this amazing way, he tries to set that sort of scheme forward. So it's all of that that's meant by believe cosmically. Now, why do that? Why bother doing that? As you know, many postmodern voices would suggest that this is the quintessential example of what we should abandon, right? That any kind of large summation, picture-taking view that claims to have a picture of the whole is of all things most to be distrusted, because it's bound to be distorted by politics and hidden agendas and power in various ways that blinds us to its very nature. So that the very idea of taking something and affirming a large global narrative, in this case even more than global, cosmic narrative about why does the universe exist and what is God doing in the universe, is an incredibly bold thing. And it should be spine-chilling. It should be the kind of thing that should cause us to be extremely humble about making such an affirmation. It is not grounds for some sort of cocky attitude about understanding the keys to the universe in some sort of flip way. This is like God, I mean, Calvin's language is that God has stooped to talk baby talk to us in order that we might have some comprehension of the nature of God. So what are we affirming by this cosmic belief cosmically? I'd say, well, we're affirming God's baby talk. And in doing so, we're trying to get something right and something not right. I was just over in the bistro, and there's this very sweet little girl named Daisy, who is about, how old is she? Maybe like a year and maybe a little more than a year. And she is just learning to use certain words. So she was pointing to chopped up tomato that her mom was putting on her tray and said, apple. I love that. And I was studying the philosophy of language, and especially the philosophy of language related to theories about reference, how it is that language actually refers to anything. And while I was doing this, which is a highly skeptical branch of philosophy, because ultimately the argument is that language doesn't refer and that you can't really do this. So anyway, I was studying this every day when we were teaching Peter to speak, right? So every day I was reading about how language doesn't refer and how words are meaninglessly attached and not connected to what the thing is that they're actually meant to refer to, and how impossible it is that language ever refers. And then I would come home and I'd go, apple, tomato. And it sort of seemed to work. But anyway, I know that the discussion is more complicated than that. But anyway, so my point in this belief cosmically is that I do think that we would be without a leg at all to stand on. And we are in that position unless it is the case that God has in some way spoken. Right? That is the radical Christian claim about why we dare to say these things, because of the affirmation that God has in some way been self-revealing. So that what we're trying to bear witness to is not what we've fashioned, not a religion that is our own making, but we're trying to say what we're trying to do here is bear witness, not to my latest and greatest idea of how to put the universe together, but to what it is that God has been self-revealing. Now, does that revelation happen in culturally conditioned terms? Does it happen in culturally specific settings? Does it happen in a specific set of languages? Does it happen in a specific set of geopolitical times? It does. It has all those impairments, you might say, to the nature of that kind of claim. And yet, again, in the language of Scripture, it would be those very elements of specificity that actually make it, A, possible for us to understand, but B, a sign that it is, in one sense, ultimately baby talk. So it's always grounds in making a cosmic belief affirmation. We are doing it, I think, out of a deep sense of humility and out of what Paul, the most confident of all apostles, says is we see, but we see through a glass darkly. So it's always that double affirmation. We're claiming that there's something there. We're claiming there's something to be seen, but we're claiming that we see it through a glass darkly, which is what I think breeds some genuine degree of a pause and humility and restraint on otherwise outlandish overstatements that especially people of religious faith can make about the nature of things, where we just like, you know, pretend that we know more than we really do. And that's not the case. But we are meant to trust what God has revealed as God's cosmic purposes, right? That's the big picture. But then, if that's really true, that we believe in a God who has this cosmic vision, then we also have a context in which we're meant to live, and in this case, we're meant to live as citizens of a globe. We're meant to live human lives that have the capacity, and therefore should express the concern for lives that are bigger than our own lives, part of our own humanity. Unlike, an animal that is ultimately interested in their existence and the existence of any that they may be trying to protect in their own family, as it were. We have the ability to actually be concerned about somebody who is not related to us. We have the ability to actually extend ourselves into the world generationally. So I can be concerned about the world, not even for people that are alive today, but for people that are alive in generations to come. That's part of our humanity. I can actually think about global warming and realize its implications may not affect me or my children or my children's children, but may profoundly affect, you know, let's say, four generations out. I think it'll be much, it is now already earlier than that. I'm just meaning, let's just assume that it's out beyond my ability to actually see anybody that's actually directly affected, and I can still act now out of concern for people four generations forward. That's a human scale, right? We're made with that sort of capacity. But we're also made to extend, therefore, not just through time, but geographically. So I can be concerned as a human being about people that I literally can't see. So living in a world now where we actually are informed about people that we can in some certain logical way see, we are meant to actually engage with concerns around the globe. Now, it's really important that we here too acknowledge genuine humility. You and I are not ubiquitous. We don't exist everywhere, right? We're not in all places at all times. We're just really where we are, right? It's quite a big enough challenge to just occupy one person's space, right? I'm not trying to be omnipresent. I'm not trying to be multifunctional. I'm just trying to be I'm just trying to live my life. But in living my life, it is actually possible to be a faithful steward, not as a superhuman, but as just a human. In other words, again, really human scaled, not bigger than human scaled, to actually care about another person in some other place who doesn't have direct impact on my life, given my circumstances, but who I can elect to be concerned about as an act of faith, as an act of intellectual, emotional, economic, social, and spiritual concern. I can actually do that work. That's a legitimate expression of my humanity. Now, it would be superhuman if I thought somehow I, or even we, were meant to, by ourselves, be the caretakers of that grand whole, right? So the great error of a conference like the conference that we did a couple weeks ago would be any suggestion that somehow the weight of that reality is out now actually truly on your shoulders or mine. I mean, in some really true frontline, here we stand, we can do no other kind of way, as though it really is on our shoulders. That's not what the conference was meant to do. What the conference is meant to do is to say there is real concern, and part of what you and I, as individual people, as people in a body of Christ, as people in a community, as people part of a global community called the church, are meant to do is engage in those realities. But this is where, again, our faith teaches us that we're not the final line. God is the final line. We're not the final stewards. God is the final steward. But we are meant to be really significant actors in the world. And therefore, part of our full and genuine humanity is to step toward those kinds of global needs, even though they're not my immediate neighbor, even though their needs are something that I could literally turn a blind eye to. I could ignore those realities and simply get on with my own private life. That would be to fall prey to what the Bible would call living subhumanly, right? Living humanly means I bear the appropriate level of responsibility, neither too much as though I'm pretending to be God, nor too little as though it has nothing to do with me. The reality of being a neighbor, in the terms that Jesus defines it in the Gospel of Luke, is that we are neighbors insofar as we are fully human. And fully human neighbors means I engage insofar as my gifts and abilities and resources and health and spiritual dependence enable me to do that. But I'm not trying to be God, as though somehow I now have the final keeping of the needs of the world, nor am I at all called to blindly ignore them, as though somehow I'm surrendering the neighborly role that I'm actually supposed to enact. So if I choose to ignore being a neighbor, I'm living subhumanly. This is the crisis. This is why God says so much to the prophets about Israel ignoring their needy neighbors. They're living subhumanly. But trying to live more than humanly, as though it's really ultimately my responsibility, is also a problem. So the goal is to engage globally. So believe cosmically, engage globally, serve locally, which then comes down to, okay, but within the confines of my own specific body, education, resources, mind, heart, soul, and strength, what am I going to do where I live about those things? Now, that's both about what's right in front of me where I live, serve locally for the sake of local need, but it's also what do I do locally for the sake of need that's not local, right? So I have to do it someplace. I don't do it in midair. I do it like where I live. I have to do something where I am. Even if I'm responding to global need someplace far away, I have to do it in the context of where I am. So I think there's a sense of idealism that often suggests, well, when I get into some perfect space, when I finally have boundless discretionary time, when I really no longer have any worries in my life, then I will turn to some sort of larger concern. Well, duh. I mean, that moment's never going to occur, right? I mean, there's never going to be a time when all those things are duly put together. So that becomes an illusion that we chase as a kind of idealism. And it's not really an idealism that honors the dignity that we've been given as human beings or the neighborliness that we're meant to actually express. So it has to finally come down to really tangible, physical, material, emotional engagement where we really are. So it has something to do with belief that's cosmic, about God, about the nature of reality and the meaning and purposes of the world. It has something to do with really engaging and carrying global concerns and needs and awareness. And it finally comes down to what are we going to actually do about it out of the specific space that we occupy in the world. Does this make sense? So I'm just trying to sort of summarize where I think we've been. Anybody want to make any comments or questions about any of that? Doing our work. This painting, which I don't like very much, is nevertheless interesting to look at. Which is a simple point. What I don't like about it is that it's sort of I just find it interesting now to look at a painting like this. And when I think about work, I think about what I have often experienced when I've come back from other parts of the world and come back to the Bay Area. I especially have felt this, I've said this before, but I've especially felt this when I've come back from India, where you feel this incredible sense of the unbelievable industriousness of everybody just trying to survive every day. I mean, just that feeling of everybody is working, just trying to exist. And there's something about when you come back to the Bay Area, you have this feeling of like, gosh, like, where are the people actually working? I mean, who's doing anything other than driving? And where are they doing it? And obviously our work on the whole happens inside buildings. So if you're driving by or walking on the street, you don't see the work. There's actually obviously a ton of work that's going on, but you're not seeing it. And because our work is ever more service-oriented rather than actually labor-oriented, there's not a need to be outside, and it's a handicap to be inside. So clearly, I mean, it's a strength for us. It's a handicap for people that are doing physical labor to be inside. They need to be outside doing the work. So there's this sense of it literally becoming invisible, even though it's present. But there's something about this picture that makes me feel like all the kinds of labor that was going on, especially in Europe at the time of this painting and in the United States, that's not represented by the people in this picture. Now I would project backward anachronistically perhaps and say it feels very much like a middle-class picture. It's a painting of middle-class people doing largely middle-class things. It may be lower middle-class and upper middle-class, in some cases higher. But it doesn't, you know, it's all people of the same color. It's all people of a random village. And the interesting and amazing thing about work, especially if we're going to think about it in these you know, believe cosmically, engage globally, and serve locally, is understanding these things from a much larger swath than just the particular tasks. We all have our own particular way that we might insert ourselves into this picture, right? We could think of the daily tasks that we do, and we could think of the labor that we are about, or the labor that we see around us. But there's this tremendous sense that labor, the work, in the capital W sense that I'm meaning it here, involves the most menial of ordinary tasks that all of us do, from, you know, brushing our teeth and going to the bathroom to the highest, most abstract and philanthropic, cosmic kind of concerns that we may have. All of that involves the nature of our work, and I think that I want us to think about it in those terms. And this picture is only a cryptic way into that. So let's think about it in different ways. Let's think, among other things, about the privilege of work. Work is really seen in the Bible, first and foremost, as an act of privilege. I hope that you know that's part of your kind of functioning theology of work. Notice the way that we first see work described in the opening verses of Genesis, beginning at Genesis 1, verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over the wild animals of the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created humankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth." God said, "See, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit, you shall have them as food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning, the sixth day. The first portrait of work, as I think given in those verses, is an image of work as an expression of our being made in God's image, right? It's out of the distinct capacity of being creatures made in God's image that we have the capacity for work in the way that we're thinking about it tonight. So it is not the work of existence only. It's the work of responsibility. It's the work of tending, of stewarding, it's the work of creating, it's the work of filling and multiplying and valuing and engaging in these sorts of terms. So work is really first and foremost actually a privilege. And whether it's the work of a craftsman or whether it's the work of somebody in a computer service center in Bangalore, India, which is what this other picture is, it is a privilege to be able to engage in work. Now, not all work, it needs to be said, is of equal privilege, right? And not all work is necessarily intrinsically human or human honoring even. Obviously, there's lots of forms of work which are not both either the conditions or the labor itself, or sometimes both. So when you think about, as we will in a moment, about many of the conditions of work, clearly it's not a privilege. But work as a category is a privilege. And work in many, 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 many instances is a privilege. It's a gift. And it doesn't necessarily have anything to do, of course, with compensation. So the privilege of work is not the privilege of getting paid a lot or getting paid a little or getting paid not at all. It's the privilege of the actual labor. It's the engagement in the task, the giving yourself to the intrinsic thing that you're doing. And whether, again, it's simply the menialness of a very basic routine task, or whether it's something that taxes every dimension of your humanity, which that might under certain circumstances, but other tasks that may well really encompass the whole of who we are, work is an extraordinary task. Can be an extraordinary privilege. All through this, what we're talking about is both the ideal and the reality. I would say in many, many instances, even when people dislike their job, it can still be a privilege that they work, not only because they get paid for being working, which hopefully they do, But because it actually is a better thing for a person to be working. And again, by working, I'm not meaning equals a job. That's a different thing. I'm not talking about work and jobs. Often they're the same, and often we use the word interchangeably. It may be that our principal work is our job, but it may be that our principal work is not our job. Or it may be that we don't have a job, and that our principal work is really something else that we engage in. But what I'm talking about is sort of the thing to which we give ourselves as a response of our own gifts, the needs that we see before us, the creativity that may be within us, the opportunity that maybe presents themselves in relationships or circumstances around us. It's all that our work is about. And our job may be something related to that, it may be unrelated to that, and our job also has versions of work. Certainly the portraits that you get in these two pictures are probably these two people's work. I mean, I don't know that about both of them, but the one on the right, I would bet, is his job. The one on the left may well have been his job, either way. So the privilege of work. The next thing is the scope of work. The scope of work is, as I've already indicated, something that we really need to think about as an incredibly broad array. When we think about work, we may think largely about the work that we do. And our work, of course, positions us in the world. One way of describing our sociology is what is the work that we get to do, right? So I remember being in a hospital in England one time for about a week, and I had only lived there for about a week at the time that this happened. I had an accident, and I ended up in the hospital. This was an amazing thing in its own right. This was during Margaret Thatcher's days when she hadn't yet corrected the national health system, and I'd arrived a week before and had an accident when I was visiting a friend in Cambridge. I was living in London. I'd gone to Cambridge without my passport, without any identification except my California driver's license, Washington driver's license at the time. I roll up to this hospital, sign one little half sheet of paper, and for that I had a surgery, an operation, and healthcare for a full week on the goodness of the British healthcare system. It was quite an amazing thing. Anyway, so this also became a fascinating little sociological moment because I could close my eyes and listen to people in the room. And by the degree, the class related to the accent of their voice, I could tell you what their job was. So I made it this little game to close my eyes and listen to people talk and go, let's see, that's the tea lady. Yeah, that's the tea lady. He's the consultant. He's like the highest in the pecking order, right? I mean, it's no great science, right? There's just this array of English accents. And your position in the world is determined by, it's reflected in your accent, and it's also in some ways determined by your accent. But in any case, the scope of work just contained in that room, it went from everything from somebody who got probably below what would be considered a living wage to somebody who was presumably making quite a lot of money as a senior consultant in the hospital. Our lives and the work that there is to be done in the world, of course, covers the whole array of the human condition. So as a church, we're connected to people who, as untouchables in northern India, are given among the lowest of all possible pieces of work to do, which is cleaning the latrines and doing that kind of work for which they get, you know, one piece of bread a day. So there's that level of work to people who, among us and among many in our church, are in circumstances of unbelievable privilege where the opportunity to do work, again, whether it's volunteer or paid, encompasses every dimension of our mind and our imagination and our will and our intentions, sometimes for good, sometimes for bad, complex, simple, all kinds of things. The picture on the left is just meant to be a woman who's a physician. On the right, a different kind of scope of work. Here are faces of four children in Ghana who are slaves, and slaves in this case, in a rock kiln, where they sit, because of the debt of one of their grandparents, they sit in this rock quarry breaking rocks every day. That's their job. That's their work every day. Their survival depends, and the survival of their family, depends on them being willing slaves for what is supposedly going to be the payment of a debt, which of course they can never accumulate enough money at any given time to be able to pay off, so, which then keeps them in perpetual slavery, which is what cumulatively contributes to the kinds of slavery that many studies have recently suggested is somewhere between 25 and 27 million people in the world are enslaved. There are more people in slavery today than there has ever been in human history. So, scope of work, amazing array of the things to which we have the opportunity to give ourselves, and or the conditions that require that we give ourselves to them. So so all of that is part of the curse of work is another part of it. So while work begins as this great privilege, as you know, one of the things that happens in God's judgment of Adam and Eve is that work takes a different turn. Let me find the right verse. The Lord God, this is in chapter 3 of Genesis, the Lord God said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, cursed are you among all animals and among all wild animals. Upon your belly you shall go, and the dust you shall eat all the days of your life. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers, and he will strike your head, and you will strike his heel." To the woman he said, "I will greatly increase your pangs in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children, yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." And to the man he said, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree about which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread until you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken. You are dust, and to dust you shall return." So part of the curse of work that we all experience, those Monday mornings when you go, "Well, it's sure Monday again, isn't it?" Are those moments where you think, "Okay, this is part of the anguish of it. It is unrelenting. It doesn't stop. It doesn't change. It may feel tedious or pressured, or it may feel as though it held promise and then doesn't. It may feel as though it's squandering our gifts instead of using our gifts. It may feel as though what we're giving ourselves to is something that's a sham and completely not what it appears to be. Or it may be something that that we think is just of no particular meaning to us, even if it's of meaning to other people. I think of a man in our connected to our church who found a number of years ago a certain little niche, complicated legal niche, that he could occupy. And he does this particular legal thing that helps certain companies in certain ways in a very routine way, and has done this with phenomenal success for the last, I suppose, 15 or 20 years. He's sold two companies that he's created as a consequence of this niche. He finds it totally soul-killingly boring. He will say that. But for reasons attached to the enticement of the earnings that come through doing this tedious task, he just keeps doing it. So here's somebody who really, in their capacity and their intellect and their training and education, is all about privilege. He feels like he is a slave to his success, and can't yet decide that he really hates it enough to be free from it. So every day he goes back to just do this thing again. And that's an example of what somebody who might be in a rock quarry in Ghana doesn't think somebody who's an upper-class white American would ever experience. And yet, really, in a very profound way, he is a trapped, somewhat tortured person as a result of this. So work can be a curse, right? You can find the magic, like the widget, the thing, the task, the ability, the hole that we think we're going to plug, and we plug it really well. And then it becomes just like something we are enslaved to, rather than something that actually gives us life or gives other people life or whatever. Now, it can be much worse than what I've just described. This is a picture, again, of children who are enslaved in another circumstance, this time in a village in eastern Africa. Then there's the idol of work, where it's just something that we give ourselves to. We just we literally bow before it in exhaustion and otherwise. It gets completely distorted. It becomes our crowning experience. It is who we are. It becomes our identity. It's the thing that we are in the world. It's the thing before which we will sacrifice almost any and every other thing. Men are especially vulnerable to this, but I think in the workplace, but I think women can be as well. And both men and women can make idols of work outside the workplace as well, whether it's the work of creativity, whether it's the work of some sort of accomplishment or some other kind of interest that we may have. We can make an idol of it. We can simply make too much of it. We spend too much time dwelling on it, fixating on it, fixing it, making it perfect in some sort of, you know, totally absorbing way. And it's ultimately not just the thing that puts us to sleep socially and intellectually and spiritually, but it's the thing that can also be a sign of the curse of work. Because part of the curse is that it can seduce us, or we can allow ourselves to be seduced by it, into making it simply what it can't ever sustain being, which is the thing that is meant to give us meaning and purpose and value. Now, it does have meaning and purpose and value. There is a real sense that work can contribute those things to us. So it's not an all or nothing thing, right? It's not as though work is not at all about those things. It is about those things. It's part of why our work actually really matters. It really matters that we do the things that we believe we are skilled and capable of doing. But it can easily flip beyond that into something which is then far beyond what it could ever sustain, and we lose ourselves. And obviously Dilbert, among others, is an expression of some of the modern forms of how that lostness occurs, right? I mean, the reason Dilbert is so amusing to read is really just because even if you don't work in a setting that's like that, it's not hard to recognize it, and every work setting has elements of that sense of lostness that the Dilbert cartoons express. So, and a lot of it has to do with the idol of work. I mean, you know, when I read Dilbert, it often seems to me that it is a cartoon strip about idol making, and the way that influences how different characters within the comic strip relate to one another, and that who gets to control what idols are first. So. It's a very, very, very problematical part of work. And then there are the limits of work. I love this picture. Do you understand the problem? Yeah, two left hands. We will reach a place where work just will not go right. It will not go right. It won't be right. It won't achieve what we thought it was going to do. We've given ourselves to it, and we end up with two left mittens. I mean, it just is like, and you go, how did that ever happen? How did I ever end up with two left mittens? I mean, I was earnest. I was trying to do the best thing. I thought I was really going to get two, you know, left and a right. I really thought I had gotten it. I thought it through again. I woke up thinking, right, a right and a left. It's really clear to me. Nobody needs to teach me about right and left. I understand right and left. And yet, I end up with two left mittens. And I don't know anybody who has ever taken a job seriously where they haven't had seasons of life where you end up with two left mittens, where you just go, what is that about? I don't get it. And it's very helpful, I think, to be able to just go, this is a left mitten day, right? I think there's just, or a left mitten year, or whatever, a decade. There's times when you just go, oh my gosh, will I ever stop making left mittens? Why do I keep doing this? Why can't I find some way of getting out of the left, double left mitten problem? And it's partly because it's intrinsic in work, right? So part of it has to do with just acknowledging, well, there's just ways that work is going to finally, if it actually is meant to carry the full weight of our being, our relationships, our meaning, our engagement in the world, finally there's going to come a double left mitten time when you just go, you know what? It's just not a lot more than two left mittens. And therefore, okay, it's fine to have done it, but boy, that's not worth staking my whole existence on. That's not why I've lived. That's not what I'm actually committed to doing. And I don't know of any job that at the end of the day won't in some way or another finally spend itself, right? I mean, I have thought about this this week because of the elections and thinking of all the politicians who were voted in, absolutely confident that there'll never be double left mitten days for them. And all the politicians that were voted out who just go, oh my gosh, I mean, it would never occur to me that I would have actually ended up being the person with two left mittens, right? I mean, there were examples of people who actually did it to themselves, right? Politicians who every poll indicated no chance they were going to lose, and then they make some gaffe and suddenly it ends up with two left mittens, and you go, guess what? Nobody wants to elect somebody that makes two left mittens, so you're out of here, and now we're going to get somebody else. But it's not because that person that's been voted in isn't going to also have their left mitten days. So it's just, it's this interesting recognition of the limits of work. It's meaningful. It's really worth doing. It's worth giving a lot of ourselves to. But it's not enough for the whole of our lives. It's not enough to sustain who we are. It's not big enough to be those kinds of things. It's just something useful in the day. This is, again, coming out of my times in India, I've come back thinking, you know, if I did one meaningful thing in my whole life, like one really meaningful thing, that would be a privilege beyond most people's daily experience, where really their sense of being able to do something that is meaningful is really their survival or the survival of their family. That is meaningful. I'm not saying that. But beyond the meaning of survival, I get to do things every day that many people, and I would call at least privileged gifts of meaning in the world, right? I get to do meaningful things every day. That's an amazing privilege. So, I mean, I do understand that. And at the same time, I look at the large human scene and go, but that's not normative, to get to have a job where many and most of the things that I actually get to do are more or less meaningful. That's a staggering privilege. Because the limits of most work is really just some days, and the sum of it, the value of using time, all that, it has place, but it's very limited in its ultimate scope. So the value of work is another thing that we have to somehow face. Here I'm thinking, and I'm using the scales sometimes identified as the scales of justice. I'm not meaning that in this case. I'm really meaning more that the value of work is always a trade-off, right? So I'm just using a scale here in the sense that when I put certain things on one side of the scale, the other scale goes up, and I have to figure out what are the other things that I put in. So if I put work on one side, if I put whatever I call my work on one side, then on the other side, there are going to be other things that I'm either not going to attend to at all, and I'm just going to be a one-sided scale and just decide, you know, the whole weight of who I am is going to go on one side. Or I'm going to try to come up with some sort of either rhythmic or daily or weekly or monthly balance to some degree, more or less, between these two things. And what are the things that I'm going to put on the other side, and how do they get there? So for some people, the value of and the pain, let's say, of their work is all about putting money on the other side, right? What balances the scale is, I hate my job, but I get paid, right? So somehow that's what keeps the scales in balance. But for many people, that ultimately becomes a completely insufficient balancing act. So you say, well, okay, I more or less may think or not think that I'm getting the appropriate balance. But in the end, the money itself is not enough. So I'm looking for something else that's going to balance the amount that I give to my work, whatever that is. So it could be relationships. It could be recreation. It could be opportunity. It could be time. It could be play. It could be contributions of some sort of kind. It could be the intrinsic meaning of what you're doing. That you face this particular task, it's a really hard and challenging thing, but the counterpoint is, but it's so meaningful to do that I'm willing to actually exercise my heart, mind, body, strength to be able to make it possible. I remember this long interview with this guy who does one of the most involved heart operations that apparently can be done. I've forgotten now the details of it, but you know, it's like he's redesigning your whole circulatory system in a 16-hour operation or some such thing. And he does this every day. And he was interviewed for this, not just because he's one of the leading surgeons doing this particular complicated surgery, but because he's one of the only people that is actually able to do it like 5 days a week, because he finds it so energizing to do this work, and has done this at this rate for something like 8 or 10 years or something. And obviously they were saying, how can you possibly sustain this? I mean, every day you're like completely rewiring a person. I mean, what is that about? How could you? Okay, so you can do it a week, maybe you can do it for a month, but like for 5 or 10 years or whatever long, long season this was. And his argument in this, he said, first of all, I realize that if I don't do this, the person will die. There's really, if they actually get to me, there's not a chance that they're going to, there's somebody else that's going to resolve it. So I actually feel every day like genuinely I'm either choosing to save a person's life or not choosing to save a person's life. And I want to save people's lives. So that's why I went into medicine. That's why I went into this particular kind of medicine. That's why I developed this particular specialty. So I'm committed because I want people to live. But I'm also committed because I love the creativity and the energy and the fascination of the endless problem solving that goes on when you do this operation every day. And there, he described, you know, these five critical points in every operation when you don't really know whether you're going to make it or not make it. And then you finally make it through this certain next, and you go, okay, great, now we're on to the next one. And he said, I just find that so energizing that really I have to kind of come down at the end of the day off of the hyperadrenaline of actually doing this, even though it lasts all this. And he talked about the music that he listens to, and he kind of has this whole sway of musical themes that he listens to and uses over the course of the surgery, because different kinds of music help him through different kinds of passages in surgery. And again, it was all about, in a way, his own unique temperament. Clearly a person who's just like wired to be able to do this in a way that, that very, very, very few people would be able to sustain. But also the value to him, both to the patients, which seemed genuinely in this article to be like the frontline thing, like to really think, I have people's life in my hands. It actually matters that I do the operation, because if I don't, they won't live. But I can't, he said, I can't. That doesn't mean that I can fix everybody, but I can fix somebody today. So should I, or should I play golf? I think I'll just fix somebody today. That's what I'll do. So there's a sense of the value to the people, but also the value for his own intellect, his own energy, his own rhythm of how he spent his life. He had obviously no other life. He had nothing else going. He said, I don't really care. I mean, I know people say to me, you know, you should really get a life. I go, I have a life. I have a really amazing life. I love doing this every day. I wanted to keep doing this as long as I survive, because this is like the thing I feel like I've been made for. Now, I don't know, of course, anything about his psychology beyond what I'm just describing, or let alone anything about his spiritual life per se. But I was motivated by this sense of the qualities of value. And each of us in our work do tap into that, right? We do end up doing work that we value, or we don't do it. I mean, even if we have a job that's requiring something, if we don't really value it, we'll probably find some other way of doing it rather than actually doing the thing that we don't value. On the whole, that's part of our privilege. There are many people in the world who really have to do the thing regardless of the fact that they really don't care about the widget or how it goes in the machine. They will end up like keeping doing it every day because that's what's required. But part of our gift of living in a privileged culture and society and setting like ours is that we can actually think about the value of work, engage the value of work, even fine-tune the value of work so that we actually can make it more valuable by certain ways that we have freedoms of responding. It's an amazing, amazing feature of our work. Then there's the redemption of work. This is just an image from Shawshank Redemption, which I happen to love as a movie. Anyway, the redemption of work. One of the amazing things about work is that it does have a way of resolving things in our lives, right, that are not necessarily the target of our labor. Like, for example, I think of people who are in deep grief, who, when they are able to work, are able to work out some of the issues of their own psychological, emotional need. Like, they have to show up. They have to do the job. They have to, like, keep doing the thing. And there is a quality of redeeming themselves, redeeming their own mental health, redeeming their own relationships by just literally putting your body in the slot. There's something really redemptive about that. To be utterly free from that, which is what we sometimes call retirement, in that utter disengagement, likewise, is a dangerous season, right? This is one of the challenges that, again, both men and women have to work through as they move into that retirement. What is it going to mean when the structure of my redemption, which on a daily level has been the health of I need to show up, I need to do a job, I need to get some things done, is suddenly gone, right? So there's this rhythmic change that now is varied. So when you're, but again, whether you have a job or whether you're talking about work in this broad sense, the expectation, the need to do the thing, to do it perhaps repeatedly, the need to engage in as significant a way as it relies upon. But even the most menial thing, I mean, to me this is one of the reasons why, for some reason as a kid early on, one of the jobs around our house that I really loved and that I still really actually love is actually just washing dishes. And that's an example to me of work that's really redemptive. There's something about the process, the heat of the water, the soap, the cleansing, the mechanicalness of it, the utter repetitiveness of it, that it's the same every time you do it, that it's always the same kind of process, it's usually the same dishes. There's something about that that's really wonderful. Now, we have a dishwasher, and I am grateful for a dishwasher, let it be said. But I have to say, there is something that I rely on the dishwasher. But there is something really about washing dishes that is an example of what I'm getting at. That it can be really a routine, a very menial routine, and there's something really life-giving to me about that. One of the things that we do in our family for Thanksgiving is to go down to our family cabin at Mount Hermon, where there isn't a dishwasher, and you have obviously the greatest stack of dishes. And one of the parts of that whole experience that I love the most is what I grew up with as a kid, which was the family all being around, having eaten, and then everybody sort of, more or less scavenging and clearing up elements of it. But then finally the moment comes where you actually have to, like, wash the dishes. I just really like that. And there's something about that process that, again, is really like it grounds my life in a big way. And all of us have tasks that in some way or another are those kinds of tasks. We need that work. We need, like, really practical work that we do every day, whatever that may be. Some of it we may not even like, but it's wonderful if we can find the things that are. And in any case, the redemption that I'm trying to talk about here is not the redemption of stuff that we just like or dislike. It's whether we like it or dislike it, it's really helpful that we have to show up and do it, whatever it is. And that there's something really valuable about that process of how we've been made and how we engage in it. And then there's the offering of work, which is how we simply take our work and make it a gift. Ultimately, our work in the ways that we've been thinking about it, is an offering to God. That certainly is the framing assumption. But there's also a way in which the offering of our work is offering that we give to the people that are affected by our work. So part of what we're meant to do is literally to give our work away. Now, there are kinds of work which seem to be sometimes less prone to be means of offering, or the worker is deprived of any connection. This is actually the Marxist critique of labor, I think, is an extremely powerful critique, which is that with increasing mechanization and industrialization, there's increasing distance between the worker and the fruit of their labor, right? I mean, that's a completely fair and appropriate description of many people's circumstances. So if we're at one stage in the mechanization process, by the time it actually comes out, wherever it is down the line that makes an effect on somebody else, can be so distant that our sense of attachment between what we contribute and the fruit of our labor is so distant that there's no sense of satisfaction. And part of what offering our work is meant to be about is a sense that it has a trajectory that's beyond ourselves, right? Part of our work is literally taking it and then giving our work. It may be giving our work to our boss. It may be giving our work to the colleagues that we work with. It may be giving our work to the people that are served by the setting that we're in. It may be the work that we give as we serve in our neighborhood. It may be the work that we give as we create something in our home. It may be the work that we give by the offering of time to listen to somebody. It can come in so many different kinds of ways. But in the end, work really has to be an offering. If it's just a treasure, that is, if it's about hoarding, then it's sick, ultimately. It will ultimately kill us rather than actually be life-giving. There's got to be this process of giving it away. That's the nature of what our work is to be about. It's meant to be fruitful, to multiply, to increase itself. Now, capitalism tends to produce that and measure that based on, quote, the bottom line. That's it's an understandable system, but it's a tragic flaw, because it then ultimately means that it's not the intrinsic thing or the giving of the thing that actually matters. It's the fruit that's unattached, that's detached from those things. So, for example, to go back to this guy, you know, and I said to him, well, why do people pay you so much for this little niche thing that you do in the law? He goes, I have no idea. But he said, it's like I have a magic key that goes in. There's a certain cluster of problems. I go, you turn the key this way, and they go, oh, here, let me give you lots of money. You just solved the problem. But he said, the thing that I do is just that I know all this cluster of stuff so well that I know when you turn the key left, when you turn the key right, whether you need to, like, push it in just a little bit harder, whether you pull it out a little bit. But it's really just always the key in basically the same keyhole. So really, he goes, it's all about, it's in the wrist, it's in the fingers. But he said, it's really not about anything that's intrinsically meaningful to me. And it's not an offering that I particularly am giving to them. It's just that they're willing to give me lots of money for it. And he said, really, I find it odd now, having done it for so long, that in fact it's worth so much. I know that it is, objectively speaking, in market terms, et cetera, I understand it. But he said, it's just completely removed from the actual thing that I'm doing. I've asked him, well, then why don't you give your knowledge away? You know, if it's really a curse to you, then why have you not, like, created a situation where you're losing your job by having given it away? Why don't you find five of your great friends and just say, here, let me teach you the magic, and then let them all go and do this? Or just, like, publish it on the internet and explain to the whole world. Wouldn't that set you free? I mean, just, like, tell the world how to figure out this little key mechanism, and then you're out of it. And he goes, that's the problem. I can't bring myself to actually let go of it to that degree because it's just so pleasing. Yes, it's so it's such a satisfying idol. Yeah. Yeah, he would say that too. Anyway, by intention, our gift is our work is meant to be an offering. It's meant to be something which we release, that we let go of, not something that we try to control. It's about serving without expecting something in return. It's about just laying it down and making it available to other people. There's lots of people who are examples of this, who really understand their work as an offering and not as a right. I think there are complicated words that get introduced into language of work that has its legitimate legal place, I think, culturally, especially to protect people who could otherwise be abused. So I think there's a legitimacy to that language, but in a more ideal world, perhaps, is all I'm saying. The desire and the possibility of somebody being able to just give an offering of their work is an amazing thing, and letting go of it rather than actually trying to cling on to it. So let me stop there, and I tried tonight to come up a little more with a little more time for discussion and question answer. So, right. Yes. What do you do in situations where you're trying to pay attention to the right things, but you're required by your boss or your environment or your circumstances into paying attention to things that you consider to be the wrong things? Well, I do think part of the lesson that we can learn there can come from school, right? I mean, sometimes the wrong lesson is the wrong lesson that we determine it to be because we actually don't see the whole picture. So sometimes the thing that our boss requires of us is because they actually see what we don't see. And like in school, when the teacher says, you know, no, you actually need to do the math exercises again, and the grade school or junior high person says, but I really don't think I'll ever use this, I'm not sure that they probably are in a position of necessarily being able to determine that. And there are work settings where somebody that we may report to may actually see a bigger picture. They may understand more things than we do about what's going on, and there's the potential in that moment of learning. That's at least there theoretically. But assuming that many times that's not the case, that it's really just because of something else, you know, that's because of somebody that they report to or because of an expectation of earnings or an expectation of power or simply having had a bad day themselves, they require something of us that we think is really not a matter of paying attention. Well, I think in moments like that, and I think, again, sometimes in our work circumstances, those can be onerous at times and really quite significant. But if we also, at the same time as trying to answer that circumstance, think about people who are every day in circumstances where they're having to pay attention to the wrong thing, let's say because of slavery. In other words, like, let's put the whole thing on the table at one time. How do people where wrong is being asked of them respond to that? Well, there's lots of possibilities in our circumstance, which again is a function of privilege. I could decide if that happens often enough and deeply enough, it's the wrong job for me. So it may be broadly speaking the right job, but not specifically speaking the right job. So it may be that it's an example of a discernment process that leads you to say, yeah, this is the right category of work, but doing it for this company or for that boss isn't going to work, so I need to go and do it someplace else. So it might be that. It might be trying to actually learn deeper skills in some other area than the task itself. So it may be a matter of saying, learning because part of work obviously always involves growth. So part of work that can be instigated by those moments is discovering, okay, so this is now really awkward. My boss is asking me to do something that I really think is stupid, wrong, whatever it may be. What am I going to do with that? How am I going to understand and sort through my own criteria of evaluating that? How will I do this in a way that's not going to be destructive to them or to the relationships with colleagues or workers? In other words, how do I really maintain integrity? How do I learn the capacity to be able to be appropriately initiative-taking in going back to my boss and saying, you know, I know that you've asked me to do these things, but I really, for these reasons, am reticent. Am I prepared to do that? How much of myself and my engagement am I prepared to put on the line in this moment, right? If I am or am not prepared to put more or less on the line, is it a function of wanting to lose my paycheck, or is it a desire, which may be a completely legitimate thing, or is it a function of really compromised integrity where I really have to ask myself, can I in good conscience keep doing this thing that I think is really wrong, let's say. So there's lessons to be learned in all that and really, really valuable things in every work setting to figure out how am I going to actually approach this with integrity and honesty and truth-telling. I say to our staff regularly, there's two things that I expect of every staff member. One is that they'll be a Christian, and the second is that they'll be an adult. And it is more frequently a problem with being an adult, I find, than being a Christian. So, and what I mean about being an adult is they really have to take responsibility for their own stuff. They have to process their own feelings. They need to go to the people that they actually have the problem with and actually talk to the person that they're having the problem with. They need to actually see it all the way through to the end. They can't just sort of, you know, start screaming and whining in the middle of it. It's like, no, you actually have to, like, stay in the conversation. You have to keep talking about the thing that's really the problem. You have to figure out together how you're going to try to analyze that. So, and then how you're going to, if forgiveness is needed, if better listening is needed, if changes are needed, well, all that needs to come with win. That's a challenge to me as much as it is to anybody else. So there's this process that you have to go through figuring out how you're going to do that. So sometimes what work settings can do is simply create the opportunity and the challenge, which we may or may not like, of actually growing up, right? And I don't mean that in some trivializing sense. I mean like actually to become a really mature person in the world who can really, like, walk into conflict without bitterness and hatred and resentment and unfair manipulation, right? Or how to have an honest, direct conversation with the person that we're having the difficulty with rather than subverting it to some other place. So in a way, that kind of moment creates opportunity, really, for lots of learning. And the learning that may need to go on may still leave you at the end of the day going, and now I've really learned all those things, but I still hate this job, and or I think this is a completely stupid thing to be doing. And you go, okay, well, now you're, in our context, we're a free agent. I mean, within certain boundaries, we can probably say, you know, I'm just not going to do this anymore. I'm going to go find another job. You know, millions upon millions of people have no such freedom, but we do. So we can pretend that we don't, but we do, and then let's figure out how we're going to handle that responsibly. Does that respond to what you're saying? Yes. Okay.
Going back to the story in Genesis,
well, but I just wanted to point out that you've made a little transition there. I mean, the earlier phrase is be fruitful, multiply, etc. Right? You can harvest. You can work the soil. There's images of work, of everything, at least that I would call work. Now, the only specific task within that work that's named is that you'll also name the animals. But that's seen as an expression of this broader set of responsibilities, which I would call their work. Now, what you're getting at is that in Genesis 3, it flips to becoming described in different words, like toil, sweat, right? It starts taking on this more onerous weight, which is the case. But work intrinsically is not those things. Work intrinsically is, I think, Genesis 1. But work has become the secondary things. And that's what I mean about the curse of work, that it actually really does bring with it often an onerousness, a weight, a grinding that can be part of it. Yes, completely.
Yeah. I think part of it is the judgment we face on.
Yeah, that's right.
If we go into it without any judgment at all,
we can
do it just blissfully.
Right.
It would sort of blissful ignorance.
Right.
But there's a point where you go, oh, there's something else in the world.
Right.
There's something we make a judgment about. Maybe I should be doing something better.
Right. And if my whole life was dishwashing, I don't think I would see it that way. Right? So I'm very aware that my privileged delight in dishwashing is I don't have to do it all the time. I do have the privilege of having a dishwasher. I do get to, like, stack them in the rack and shut the door and go, forget it. But I also get to actually also sometimes wash the dishes, which I really like. But you're right. I mean, it depends on the circumstances. It depends on the frame of reference. It depends on whether it's being laid on me or whether it's being taken up freely. I mean, there's all kinds of things about work that affect our attitude about it. Did you want to go on and make some further point, though?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think too often times we get hung up in judging.
Yes, yes.
Our work.
Right, yeah.
And that gets in the way.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very, very important point. That's right. Yeah, it's a very good point that often, because of our freedom and because of privilege and because of how we've been made with the capacity for discrimination and, you know, reflection and all those kinds of things, we can come to value and devalue or be valued and devalued in various ways around the work that we do. And I think it's very, very true. And I think one of the great dilemmas, really, of classism is that it separates people often around work that they do, and then work that cuts across, that goes up or down the class scale, can end up becoming judged in different ways, which are thought to be higher and lower. Whereas, in fact, our humanity is really something, I think, that is meant to stay in touch with the full range of those realities, rather than to sort of, you know, where classism can kind of hand off our life, pieces of our life, to someone else to do. I remember when we lived in that magic bubble called Carmel by the Sea, there was a family in the church who were the first people that I knew to have cell phones that they regularly used. They also had a cellular fax machine in their car, and there was I'd never seen that before. I didn't know that you could do this, but they had this very elaborate thing that allowed them to receive fax machines in their car, and faxes in their car. And in the context of that little configuration, one of the things that was so amazing was to watch how many pieces of their life had been handed off to other people to do. And almost all of the physical dimensions of their life were really, other than pleasurable ones, were handed off to somebody else. And it felt really like such a loss to me. It had its kind of intrigue, I don't deny that, but it also felt like, oh man, this is really not a healthy way of being a person in the world. They're not in touch with almost any of the really ordinary things that involve physical existence. And there's something about that that I think isn't just about being organic because of living around Berkeley for all these years, but that's really about staying in touch with being physical creatures who are dependent on really physical things that we have to do for ourselves, even though in that case it was, you know, it would have been still privileged physical tasks. I'm not pretending it wasn't. It felt like they were just, like, removing themselves entirely, and that's really a loss. Yeah. Yes, wealth can do that. That's right. Yeah. And we're all incredibly wealthy. So this is really a challenge to all of us, yeah. So does the particularity of our circumstances, where we may be the only person actually able to meet a certain need, mean that we should become? Does it become a justification for just continued work and an abandonment of other responsibilities? Am I getting the question? Well, I think probably that it would be imaginable to make that argument to me, at least it would be imaginable to make that argument on a seasonal basis, but not as a permanent thing, right? I think there's ways that you could say for a period of time, if you find yourself in that circumstance, I could imagine that it could take priority over other of life's needs and demands. But what it would also say to me is the person should go and try to find other people who are actually going to be able to help and help to complement their skills or to train other people to be able to do what it is that they're doing or whatever it may be. There is a great lure of making other people idolize our work, right? So part of the benefit process of work is that we try to make ourselves indispensable, even though we may not be indispensable. So whether third world or not, there are lots of people who do their job in such a way as to make them convince themselves and or other people that they're the only ones who can do it and that it really won't be the job that it should be unless they themselves do it. That's called idolatry, not self-sacrifice. That's about self, you know, adoration rather than the sacrifice of. But for a season, I think there's times when relative priorities, sometimes family will distort our work, and that's appropriate. There's other times when work may distort elements and seasons of our time with our family, but not in the big picture, I would say. I would think that's, in my view at least, that's a seasonal. It's a seasonal thing. Yeah, Melvin. Right, right, exactly. So really, in a way, one way of gathering up what you were just saying is that central to all of this of doing of our work is what we've talked about in the earlier part of this section, which is really that our life is meant to be a response to the two inseparable loves, right? Of loving God with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength, and loving our neighbors, ourselves. And part of what you've just testified to is that a central piece of our work is really our love for the people that are around us in the midst of the processes and mechanisms and patterns of doing labor of various kinds. Ultimately, it's about the relationships that are in those contexts and how we give ourselves in love or receive love and dignity from those contexts. Yeah. Yes. Right. Yeah. The way that work is so deeply attached to a sense of monetary gain, and that without that, the work itself becomes devalued. Yeah, it's a very sad reality, but that is the case. It's one of the, it's hurtful on an individual level, and it's hurtful. It damages in a way the reality of what you're actually giving. Yeah, it's a distortion, but it's a lie that permeates our culture in a very, very significant way. Yeah. Yeah, there's so many different layers to this, and this is obviously a very fast overview of these themes. That's very helpful. Thanks. Yeah. To your community, right? Right. Right. Yeah. So I'm just going to say this back so that people who are listening to this on CD know that you're making the point that as a woman in your early 30s, that you're talking about the tension really between paid employment on the one hand and then the value of things that are related to family life, among others, where you can give yourself but without pay, and then the way that the competing values of those two systems means that you try to either simply hold them separately or feel in way trying to figure out some way of holding both of them simultaneously, which is part of what stresses out an enormous number of young moms. I was feeling this very poignantly the other day when I happened to arrive at a moment where a mom who leaves her child at Cornerstone every day during the week was going through this a particularly problematical goodbye with this child on this particular day. And it was clear that the child was really upset, but it was also really clear that the mother was extremely upset that she couldn't, that because of needing to go to the work, which I heard her trying to explain to her little daughter that she couldn't stay, but that the daughter really wanted her to stay. It just felt like one of those, this is so, and I know, I have to know in this case that this mom is in a circumstance that she really needs the income. So the ability to just say, you're going to blow off the day, or I'm going to go do something, I mean, it's not really, her ability to actually keep life going for them as a family really required that she go to work. And yet the dilemma of how to do that when she also felt clearly in that moment like this is about the last thing in the world that I would be wanting to do, but here I am having to do it. So anyhow, it's just an example of, I think, some of the elements of what you're describing. Yeah. Yes, let's see. Yeah, you're making the point that depending on the work that we do, and in your case as a graduate student in science, that it's a highly elevated cultural value for reasons that are not entirely clear to you, whereas other things that may make a more material contribution are devalued. I think one of the things that could run through this whole conversation, and clearly does because work is so specifically monetized, is the fact that part of what the gospel is meant to do is to help us redefine how we understand these things and what it is that we truly value and what it is that we don't, and how it is that we work at trying to gain an ever clearer human and biblical vision of the people and the circumstances and the work that we're doing, rather than to simply accept the monetized system that we're handed. And that is a great, that's a great lifelong work, right? And different ones of us in different ways for different reasons are more snared or hooked by certain people or certain circumstances or certain capacities than by others. And it's a very complicated thing. Some people are, I think, relatively blind, honestly, to a lot of that. But a lot of people are not. Clearly, that's why the cultural system works as it does, because most people are attuned to it. They do use it either to their advantage or feel duped by it because other people are using it against them. So it's a very, very, very problematical thing, and it is one of the biggest pieces of how work is I think, has become a curse. So that it actually, great work, whatever it is that we call great work, which could be many, many things as we've been talking about tonight, great work is worth doing regardless of how it's monetized. But in our context, great work is only really great if, in addition to it being intrinsically great, it's really well paid. And that's just a corruption of an understanding of value and meaning and the way that the design that God has given us as stewards. Yeah. So the value of also being energizers for recasting how that value system actually gets played out is a really important thing. Yeah, extremely important. Right, because love is not monetized. Yeah. The slides are not online. Well, I can't. These I could tonight because they're not significant. But when I've used art prints, for example, I can't really do that without copyright permission. And we don't really have the mechanisms to actually keep that going. So I would be happy to show them to you personally. But that's why they're not online. Yeah. Let's close in prayer. Lord, we have talked about something that we are all engaged in. We all have work to do, whatever our employment status. We all have work to do that engages us in various ways. Sometimes that work is easy and straightforward and a source of joy. Sometimes it's a struggle. It's complicated. It's protracted. It's confusing. It's many things. Sometimes it's profoundly marring to us or to others. Some forms of work can really deeply distort our lives. So, Lord, we bring it all to you tonight, and we pray that as we think again about what it means to be public disciples, it does involve our work in many ways. It does involve the use of our gifts and skills, and I would pray for each of us here tonight that we will have a greater, keener sense of that stewardship, a greater readiness to learn all that we can, and a greater and deeper desire to really live our work as an offering to you and to the people that are around us. Help us, Lord, to discern truly what matters and to discern what doesn't or what seems to matter less. And help us to find ways, whenever possible, to give ourselves to the central things, and to honor those who do likewise. Lord, thank you for your faithfulness and love, for the questions that we've thought about tonight, and for the work to which we've been called. In Jesus' name, amen. Thanks.